Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. Now, today, my guest, I'm very delighted to introduce Dr. Juliet McGrattan. So first, Juliet, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, you're most welcome. So a little bit about Juliet before we get started. So Juliet says she wears lots of different hats, but running helps her to join all of these together. Juliet qualified as a doctor in 1996, and for 16 years, she was a GP. But she hung up her stethoscope and followed her passion. And now she helps to improve health through physical activity. In fact, she's written a book about that called Sorted, The Active Women's Guide to Health, which was published in 2017 and actually won a prize in the popular medicine category at the 2018 British Medical Association Medical Book Records. And we will make sure that there's a link to that book in the show notes, Juliet. Now, she spends a lot of her time as the Women's Health Lead and Master Coach for the 261 Fearless Global Network, which is founded by Catherine Switzer. So this empowers women from every race and background to find courage through running. So she's founder and director of Fearless Club UK and a founding member and coach of my local club's 261 Fearless Club in the Lune Valley and also in Lancaster. She also worked for Public Health England for 3 years as the lead champion for physical activity in the northwest of England. And she describes herself as a passionate runner. So fantastic introduction there, Juliet. Lots and lots of things that you've done in your life. Well, I'm looking at you now. You don't look old enough to have achieved all of that. So clearly running keeps you looking young because you're married and you've got 3 children and a dog. And you said you've got the world's biggest pile of ironing as well.
Most definitely, yeah. Yeah, I'm a busy person, but life's good.
But you're no longer a GP now. I guess that you probably think that was the right decision given the stress that GPs have been in increasingly over the last 2 years, but particularly in the last 6 months with the COVID-19 outbreak.
Yes, obviously, I couldn't have predicted at that time that we would be where we are now. I have actually been given back my license to practice if I need to chip in and help, obviously. But it was a big decision at the time, but it's been really the right decision for me. And I've been able to do so many other things to improve health in different ways, which I've really, really enjoyed.
Lancaster's in the northwest of the UK, and Northwest obviously been getting a lot of publicity for one of the areas that's currently that sort of like got the biggest spike in coronavirus cases in the second wave. Does Lancaster fit into part of that, or is that more of a rural place where the numbers are still quite low?
Well, I live kind of outside Lancaster and it is rural and the numbers are quite low, but we are very close to areas where it is very high. So we are currently on local lockdown and awaiting further instructions later today, I think, as to what the new regulations are going to be. So yeah, it's not the best place to be right now, but actually I'm very fortunate in my little village, tucked away from harm, well, hopefully.
Well, the date of our chatting is the 12th of October, which is the Monday, and that you know, Boris is about to announce what lockdowns you and I are both going to face. I'm in Bradford, and I'm
okay,
although I'm in a little sort of oasis really down by the canal here. It's a lot quieter. I'm still in a Bradford postcode, and we're in those local lockdowns that you've got, and we've got a high spike here, so I've no doubt that by the time listeners will be hearing this, we'll be well aware of exactly what additional lockdown measures we're all going to face. My previous guest was saying he'd just been to the swimming pool, and they were talking about he's in Liverpool, and he was saying that they were talking about closing the swimming pools there, and yet most of the people that go to the swimming pool he frequents are OAPs. And of course, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because while we're trying to protect people like that, if we close down one of the opportunities for them to have physical activity and social interaction, we're making things worse on the other hand.
Yeah, it's really difficult, isn't it? I think during the big national lockdown, one of the things that really came out was how important physical activity was. You know, people were allowed out for their walk or whatever once a day, and people became more active. Lots of people did. So yeah, and you need physical activity for your immune system as well as your mental and physical health. So it's a fine balance, and it's difficult. I wouldn't want to be in charge, I have to say.
Me neither. And I know it's going off message a little bit, but if you're the Prime Minister, you've got the science data of which you're not an expert. You've got the medical data of which you're not an expert. You've got the Chancellor in one ear telling you we need to protect the economy. You've got members of your own party who seem to be divided on what's the best course of action. You've got the opposition. You've got members of the public who clearly still are quite afraid to go out and mix, and other members of the public who are a bit gung-ho. Mm. And you are trying to recover from coronavirus yourself at the same time as having a new baby, and you're probably only getting 5 hours sleep. I mean, that just sounds like a nightmare scenario for anybody.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And none of the decisions are easy, are they? They're all balancing risk against benefit, and you can't get it right all the time. Yeah, no. I'm glad it's not me.
I did listen. In fact, what my guest, in chronological order, tomorrow is a doctor who practices sort of functional medicine in the United States, a British guy, actually. But I listened to him in a podcast talking about the current situation of coronavirus. We are actually seeing science happening in real time. And he said that one of the things that most people don't realize is once research papers have come out, lots of mistakes have been made by the researchers and the doctors in order to get to that thing there, because you have to make mistakes in order to make progress with your research. But we never see that. We just see the finished product. But now what we're seeing is mistakes. And we're calling these people out for being idiots because they're telling us one thing one week, and then they realize they made a mistake and they understand it better, and then they're changing their mind. So that's not indecision. That's what happens all the time with science and research. It's just now we're getting to see it as it's actually happening, and perhaps it's something we're not used to.
Yeah, the speed that we're having to adapt and find a way through is can I use the word unprecedented?
You can. Yeah. Yes. Now, okay, well, actually, I didn't get you onto the show to talk about medicine or the coronavirus. But what I did get you onto the show was to talk about another subject, which I've been, I would say, pressed. I don't think those are the right words, but definitely there's a lot of enthusiasm from my female listeners to talk about the menopause and what happens around that. Now, I've embarrassed to say I'm not particularly well educated about this, and perhaps I should be. And I think there's a lot of male coaches, I hope, will be nodding in agreement with me if they're listening to this, saying, no, I'm not either. And even if you're not a coach, you're probably living with somebody, either your sister or your partner, your girlfriend, your wife, or even your mum who might be going through this. And perhaps what we're going to talk about now will help all of the male listeners to understand this, and certainly the coaches to come have some better strategies when working with their female athletes. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, the menopause and the time around it, and what strategies that our female athletes and listeners can implement. So this is something you've spent a lot of time working with. I guess as a GP, it would have been one of your areas of biggest concern with your patients.
Yes, certainly would see a lot of women around the time of the menopause, and sometimes maybe women dealing with the consequences after they've been through the menopause as well. So as a female GP, it's something you do see an awful lot of. And then I think also in my new role and working with women and getting them running, seeing women who maybe are in the menopause and are having problems with their exercising because of it. So maybe coming at it from two different viewpoints will be helpful to you.
Okay, so I asked some of my tribe if they would be kind enough to send in some questions, and they didn't let me down. I sent you them in advance, and I think I asked you not to feel overwhelmed by the number of questions. But so clearly it's a subject that's uppermost in their minds. So I had my own questions first. So I wondered if you could start out by just briefly explaining what menopause is and the difference between, as you corrected me, the two phases of menopause.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, you know, credit to you for actually bringing this topic up and talking about it, because it does still remain quite a taboo topic. And there are conversations starting to happen about it, but there is so much more that we need to do to talk about it. So thank you for even gathering and asking these questions in the first place. I think, first of all, yeah, what actually is the menopause? And there are kind of two phases in life. There's premenopause in the years that women have before the menopause, and there's postmenopause in the years after the menopause. So menopause itself is kind of a line dividing the two of those up. And the perimenopause, which you'll very often hear, is the time leading up to the menopause. So you're premenopause from the minute you're born until the minute you hit the menopause, but you're perimenopause just in that time scale, which can be months or even up to 10 years sometimes before you actually reach the menopause. And the menopause is the time when your ovaries have stopped releasing eggs and you haven't had a period for a year. So when you get to that point and you haven't menstruated for 12 months and your ovaries are no longer releasing eggs, that's when you're menopausal. That is the menopause, if you like. And then the time after that, you become postmenopausal. In reality, it doesn't happen kind of in a sudden way. It's a time of change through for the woman's body, moving through from pre to peri to postmenopausal. And it happens over a period of years rather than being an exact moment in time.
So, is there any defined age of when this might begin? Because I've talked to one athlete who, I think she had a menopause when she was in her late 20s and early 30s.
Mm. So, I mean, the average age in the UK is 51, but your perimenopausal symptoms usually for most women start around the mid-40s, can be as long as kind of 10 years from when the perimenopausal symptoms start to when the menopause is actually reached, but it's more common for it to be a few years. If your menopause starts earlier than, if your menopause is when you're less than 45, then it's early. If it's less than 40, then it's called a premature menopause. So that woman you mentioned there would have had a premature menopause. And that's particularly important if women are in that situation and have a premature menopause, that they do receive medical treatment and specific advice just for them.
Can a premature menopause bring about some different health concerns? And I'm wondering about things like bone density, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. So most women who, if they have their menopause at 51, they're going through 51 years of having reasonably high hormone levels, female hormones mainly being estrogen and progesterone. If you have your menopause 20 years before that, say 21 or 31, as you mentioned, then you've got that extra number of years when your progesterone and estrogen particularly levels are going to be lower than they should be. And that is when you then start to notice the problems with bone density and also muscle mass as well. And both of those are very dependent on your estrogen levels. So if your estrogen levels drop early, there are going to be some consequences to that, which is why I sort of mentioned that those women need specific advice and treatment from the doctor, usually to just replace the hormones that they would have had anyway in their body until they reach the age of the menopause.
I remember when I was doing my fitness training, well, way back 30 years ago, we talked about how most females are less prone to cardiovascular disease before the menopause, but then because of the hormonal changes, that made them a bit more susceptible to it afterwards. Would that also be the same for those females who have an early menopause then, that they become more susceptible to cardiovascular problems?
Yes. It, as I say, it's that early loss of those protective hormones can put you at increased risk. So, you know, although it's quite, in some women, obviously if it affects their fertility, it's devastating for them. But also we need to think of those other aspects of their bodies when they having all those years without the correct amount of estrogen can definitely have those impacts.
Mm. So you're a female, you're in your early 40s. You know that menopause is probably going to start at some point, although you can't predict exactly when. But is there anything you can do to start preparing for this sort of definite eventuality?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because people, the minute you say menopause, everyone just thinks, oh, you know, and they kind of aren't looking forward to it, maybe dread it, have visions of hot sweats and women with fans and things. And I think, you know, yes, it can be a very difficult time, but sometimes actually it's okay. Not every woman is very, very severely affected. But I think the more you can learn about it and the more you can understand about it, the more prepared you can be for it. So, you know, reading as much as you can, speaking to other women, it's kind of educating yourself, not to make you afraid of it, but just so that you can be aware of what symptoms there might be, how it might affect you, but also what you can do to help yourself. And I think, you know, the majority of your listeners who will already be active are already really taking massive steps to prepare themselves and future-proof their body, if you like, because we know that, that physical activity is going to have a really important benefit in helping to weather the actual perimenopausal symptoms, but also for making sure their body is fit for the future, as you mentioned, with the bone strength and the muscle mass as well. So I think that is one of the things that you can know that actually feel quite confident that following your training plans and keeping active is a really important way to prepare, as well as sort of educating and learning.
About nutrition, anything you can do with your nutrition in advance there?
I think that in the many years before the menopause, probably it's not going to have that much effect. I think what happens during through the perimenopause and into the menopause is that women's bodies do change and their nutritional needs change a little bit. So I think if you can get into good habits early in the years before, then that can sort of stand you in good stead. It's like, you know, all of these things, really making sure you've got a good balanced, healthy diet, lots of fruit, vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. But I think particularly when we're thinking about maintaining our muscle mass, because I think everyone knows about bone mass, you know, they know that they've heard of osteoporosis. They know that after the menopause, they're going to lose their bone density quite quickly, about 1% a year women lose. So everyone kind of knows that. But perhaps one thing they don't know so much about is that muscle mass declines as well with age, particularly after the menopause as well. So if we want to have good, strong muscles for numerous reasons, but actually to do that, we actually need to make sure we've got the building blocks as well. So making sure we've got good proteins in our diet as well is really important.
That's a big thing, isn't it? I mean, you and I, we were talking about Stacey Sims' book, Raw, which is a resource I have definitely directed a lot of female athletes to. I think you mentioned that was something you'd done as well. She talks about LHS in there, which is lift heavy shit, yeah. Basically, in that sort of less cultured New Zealand way that sometimes comes across. But I think it gets to the point. But I do find that's something that a lot of males particularly in endurance sports do as well, is they don't lift. And I'd be saying it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, as you get older, actually the things you think you should be doing less of, you probably should be doing more of. So you probably need to do less of the long steady distance stuff and more of the highly anaerobic stuff, and definitely lifting heavy weights, because males and females suffer from a loss of muscle mass as they get older, don't they? But definitely for females, don't be worried about lifting heavy stuff. You're not going to build huge muscles.
No, I completely agree. And I think it's something probably that a lot of us, we know we don't do very much of. You know, we're quite happy to go out on the long runs, but how often do we actually get down to it and lift some weight? So I know in my own life, it's something always on my to-do list that I sometimes don't get to, but I'm becoming increasingly aware that it's something that I'm going to need more of, and trying to get into the habit of doing it, because, you know, I think what's particularly interesting that is, you know, why do we need those muscles? It isn't just about looking toned and ripped. It's for numerous things. Balance, you know, what happens when you trip and you land, if you fall forwards, if you haven't got good muscle tone and muscle strength in your ankles or your knees, you're going to hit the deck and you're going to increase your risk of falling. So we need to maintain our muscle mass for that. But we also now are starting to understand the importance that muscles actually play in our general health. And when we exercise and when we use our muscles, they release myokines, and myokines are anti-inflammatories. So we do our exercise, the myokines are released, they go around in our circulation and they act as anti-inflammatories. Now, we now know that lots of the major diseases like heart disease, diabetes, even depression, etc., are caused by a low level of inflammation. So it makes sense, you know, as we age, we lose our muscle mass, we perhaps have less myokines, less anti-inflammatory action. So if we can maintain our muscle mass, not just a case of stopping us falling over and helping us to run fast, but actually to increase the number of circulating myokines we've got, so we've got that anti-inflammatory action. So I think we're only really now starting to understand the importance of muscles. And that's a very simplified kind of explanation of it, really. But in a lot of it, we still don't know. So muscles are really, really important, and particularly important for women to be thinking about their muscles around this time.
There's a couple of things there. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I think I read that when they were talking about coronavirus and some of the comorbidities, the level of chronic inflammation you have in your body could make you more susceptible to suffering with that, and some of the lifestyle diseases as well, which sort of go along mm-hmm. with that sort of thing. So that's one reason why we need to have that anti-inflammatory process in there. Obviously, it's more complex than that. But the other thing, close to home, I can remember my mum. My mum died at the age of 58 of cancer. But I can remember when she was quite small. I think she was 5 foot. She weighed 7 stone. But she was always, you know, she always was out in the garden, working in the allotment. So she was quite strong. But I remember in her early 50s, little things that perhaps people don't consider being significant, like, so she couldn't undo the top off a jam jar. And so she would ask me to do it. And then I remember one day that she was trying to lift something that was clearly a bit too heavy for her at that time. But she was trying to lift something over her head to put it in a cupboard above her head. Fortunately, it was reasonably soft, but it dropped back and it sort of caught her on the head. And so she didn't have the strength or the power to be able to lift it up there, or the stability that comes from strength to be able to balance it while she positioned it ready to push into the cupboard. And then it was, you know, things like with my grandmother getting out of a low chair, so having to have one of those Shackleton chairs that was a bit higher because she didn't have the strength in her hips or her quadriceps. So little things that we perhaps don't notice creeping up on us, but which actually will affect your function and your life and your enjoyment of life as you get older.
Yeah, I think it's all about wanting to maintain our independence, isn't it? You know, wanting to be able to look after ourselves, live independently. And it might seem a bit doom and gloom to be talking about those things. But ultimately, you know, I think if there's things we can do now that will make our life in the future better, then yeah, let's do them.
My guest last week was talking about health extension and compressed morbidity. And it was all about, you know, what can I do to make sure instead of going into the departure lounge, sort of hobbling in there on my Zimmer frame, I come racing in on my Harley Davidson, screeching to a halt and scaring everybody, because that's how I want to end up in the departure lounge. In my mid-50s now, I've got to start preparing now to make sure that happens. And I think so I'm not sure it is morbid. I just think, again, we plan for most things in our life, but we don't seem really very good at planning for our old age. And then when it's too late, when we get there, it's too late to really make that much impact. Okay, so I'm a male partner or a friend of a female who is going through the menopause. What can I do? Or not do, I think, might be also a good question. What can I do or not do, which might help?
Yeah, I wonder if you saw, was it last year or possibly the year before, BBC Breakfast did a whole series on the menopause. And one of the things that they did was to speak to male partners and friends to get their viewpoints and to ask them how they felt about it. And it was really insightful and really interesting. And I think the main sort of take-home message from that really was to communicate, to talk, and importantly to listen, to discuss, and not to be afraid to chat about how you're both feeling, because obviously if the woman's feeling very negative about things, that can often have a knock-on effect. We know that mood changes are really significant sometimes for some women during the menopause, and that obviously has knock-on effects on relationships. So as well as the woman's kind of body image and changing and how she feels about herself. So, you know, yes, learn again yourself, educate yourself, read about it. But most importantly is communicating and asking and how they are and listening as to what you can actually do and keep those communication channels open. I think that's the most important thing I can say, really.
Now, as a coach, as a male coach of female athletes who might be going through the menopause, would my actions that you've just mentioned there, would they be any different to what you've just mentioned? Would I be doing anything differently, particularly with things like prescribing exercise or recovery?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, yeah, educate, teach yourself, learn. Communication is really important. But I think it's also particularly important to be aware of the unpredictability of symptoms. I think sometimes if you're dealing with the menstrual cycle and you're getting your head around that and how you train and with that, then it's, you know, it's usually a fairly cyclical monthly type thing. But with the menopause, it doesn't always happen that way. It can be very unpredictable. So having plans that are flexible, that can be adapted quickly, because of the variability in how the woman feels, and it is a huge variability between people as well. It's definitely not a one size fits all. So understanding that, and then again, like we mentioned before, you know, understanding the biology of it and thinking about the muscle mass, and you know, what could you be doing in terms of weight lifting, plyometrics, all those kind of things, along with perhaps thinking about balance and coordination, which again can reduce in the menopause. And just being aware of how the symptoms might make your athlete feel, particularly in terms of the regulation of heat in the body. We call it thermoregulation, you know, that that really can change. Obviously, we know women have these hot flushes and their body's trying to cool itself down, and knowing that their core temperature can sometimes be higher and they can find it hard to exercise in the heat. Being aware of those things as a coach is really important as well.
I guess a lot of that would come back to what you just said a moment ago about communication, because each of your female athletes is going to be different and responding in different ways. Not being afraid to ask the questions. But I suppose before then is asking, are you okay to chat with me about this? I'm a male coach, you're a female, are you okay to chat with me about this? And if you are, you know, I'm learning as well as we go along. So I have questions for you. So it's about being open and honest, as it would be in a husband and wife relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everybody's different. Most women that I speak to are happy to talk about it when invited to talk about it, but wouldn't necessarily bring it up. So creating the space for those conversations. And also, I guess as well, you know, if a woman doesn't want to talk about it, fine, you know, but you've got to factor these things in when you have a bad training month or whatever, what could be going on, and think about those sort of possibilities. So,
yeah, it's if I raise the issue, either via a questionnaire or some questions with female athletes about monthly cycle and how that affects their training, one of the first responses I get is, whoa, nobody's ever asked me that before. So here they are, they've had male coaches, they might be one-to-one coaches, or it might be somebody within the club, and nobody's ever asked them, well, how does this, you know, does your monthly cycle interrupt your training? Does it affect your training? Does it affect your ability to recover? Do you feel awesome? Do you feel awesome in a couple of weeks? And you know, like you're at the back of the pack on the other 2 weeks. So the fact that they don't even get asked those questions probably tells us a lot about male coaches and about maybe they're either afraid to ask the question or embarrassed to ask because they don't understand.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's a reflection on male coaches per se. I think it's a reflection on education, because and research and what we know, and generally in society about how happy people are to talk about these things, but also what information we have to give people and to adapt training according to it, because there's been so little research generally in this area, and particularly, you know, much less research that involves studies involving women than there are men as well. So I think it's almost that the importance of it hasn't really been recognized. And now that is kind of coming more to the forefront, we still don't have all the answers and many studies are still incomplete and small, and the evidence base is growing slowly. So I think that we can't necessarily just blame it on the male coaches. And I'm sure there are many female coaches who maybe haven't asked as well. And hopefully times are changing and now we can become more aware of it. Well, we can do better.
Okay, well, let's go on to some of the questions sent in by listeners. So we'll try and break it into the two phases that you mentioned there, although we did break it down into three phases, but you've corrected me on that. So let's talk about that perimenopausal stage. I think you've probably gone through these, but what are the perimenopause symptoms and what role does nutrition play in easing them? So that's slightly different to what I asked earlier about what we can do to prepare for it.
Well, in terms of symptoms, I think if you name a symptom, it'll be part of the menopause. Really, they do. Somebody made a list once, and I can't remember how many was on the list, but they were getting into the 40s or 50s. So obviously, you know, we've got the physical symptoms in terms of irregular bleeding to start with when the perimenopause is first kind of kicking in. Sometimes heavier periods, infrequent periods. Sometimes they go a little bit more frequent at times as well. And then we've got the things like the breast tenderness, joint aches and pains, weight gain, headaches, extreme fatigue, and we mustn't forget the mental symptoms as well, mental health symptoms. So I mentioned mood swings before, but sometimes depression. Women are more likely to be become depressed around the time of the menopause. Problems with concentrating, remembering, focusing, this kind of brain fog, which is described as well. So, you know, huge numbers of systems in the body involved. And you know, what role does nutrition play in easing them? It is a tricky one. I mean, I think, as I mentioned before, it's important to look at our nutrition and do what we can to make that as good as possible. I think it's important to think about hydration when you talk about nutrition as well, because if you're a woman who is having multiple night sweats, you know, you're waking up in the night and your sheets are soaking wet, and you're having maybe hot flushes and increased sweating during the day as well, you are going to be a little bit dehydrated. So I think it's really important to make sure that you're drinking regularly throughout the day, whatever fluids you prefer, you know, whether it's herbal teas or water or whatever, to make sure you're not dehydrated, because that obviously can have an effect on how you feel, as well as how you train. And then food-wise, as I say, we mentioned before, making sure that you're looking at a very healthy diet with lots and lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, so you're getting all those nutrients that you're going to need. And I generally prefer to, I'm not really a supplements kind of person. I generally think that you should, if at all possible, be able to get things through your diet. So looking, as I say, at maxing out on your fruit and veg and your whole grains, and thinking about your increasing need for protein as you get to this point in your life as well.
Same advice as we give to most athletes in nutrient density in the food you're choosing mostly.
Yes, I mean, I think that there are some foods that that some women choose to eat because they've got some kind of natural estrogens in them, if you like. So we're thinking about soy food, so edamame beans, tofu, miso, those kind of things. You know, when you look at the actual effects, you're going to have to eat an awful lot of them for them to be anywhere near replacing. They're called phytoestrogens, plant estrogens. You have to eat a lot of them to get anywhere near the levels of estrogen that you would say get in a hormone replacement, etc., or that your natural hormone levels are at. But it's worth looking at those types of foods and including plenty of them in your diet as well. But the general, you know, eating a rainbow, minimizing the junk food you eat, is all hugely important. And it's just a really good opportunity, I think, to give yourself a little bit of a nutrition MOT, if you like.
Well, you mentioned inflammation earlier, and I think there's definite link between processed foods and refined sugars and inflammation as well, isn't there? So that's another good reason for sort of tidying up your diet.
Yeah, definitely. Throwing in loads of fresh herbs, looking at spices as well. I mean, the evidence for turmeric is growing as well, isn't it? So yes, it may not have huge quantities, but you know, if there's something in your cupboard that you could add that might do a little bit, then I think it all adds up.
Well, I don't think it's, you know, I've read the same for turmeric, and I don't think it's going to do any harm, isn't it? Adding it in there to flavor some of your meals. And diversity. We had a gut health specialist on the other day, and she was talking about trying to, you know, thinking about diversity in what you're eating. And she laid down a challenge of trying to consume 40 different fruits and vegetables and nuts within a week. We had a little challenge amongst people, and I don't think anyone came close to 40. I think my best one was 32, and I thought my fridge was stocked with stuff from the market. So I still need to work on that.
I mean, you do. I think you get stuck in your ways, don't you? You know the foods that you normally eat, and they're the ones that you normally buy. So it's a good time to be kind of experimenting a little bit and looking a bit further afield and trying different things. And variety can only be a good thing. I think there's more talk now about, I'm in no way an expert on the gut microbiome, I think the diversity is potentially supposed to help that as well. And again, there's more more we're finding out about that, which I don't claim to know.
gut bacteria. That was a fascinating podcast we did.
I'm going to have to go and listen.
Yeah. Bella Lindemann was her name. She's an Australian lady, but absolutely fascinating about being the second brain and how it controls so much of what we do, from sleep quality to mood swings and everything else, you know. So, yeah, it's complex, isn't it? There aren't any simple fixes, because often it takes time and it requires multiple changes, which can be overwhelming because you don't know where to start, and trying to do several new things at once is like trying to accomplish all of those New Year's resolutions that we have, and often we just fail miserably because we've given ourselves too much to do.
Definitely. And I think if you can just do little steps, you just make a one tiny little change, then that's all of those things add up. Because an overhaul, yeah, it's for some people that works, you know, they do actually have a watershed and they completely change the way they eat. But for most of us, in reality, it's just making little tiny changes.
Yeah, give up the sugar and the processed foods would be my number one, and swap those out with vegetables.
Definitely. And I think as well, looking at good fats, so thinking about your seeds and your nuts and your olive oil, that would be a top choice of mine.
Yeah, I lost count the number of people who say, I can't eat those avocados because they're mostly fat. I'm like, man, avocados are great fat. Although if you read the Sunday Times report yesterday about the way they treat the farm workers in Kenya, we'll probably all be told that we shouldn't be having avocados now.
Yeah, well, they're my favourite, and I've just eaten the whole one before speaking to you.
Yeah, well, me too.
You can't eat half of one, because then the other half goes off. So
I'm quite fond of avocado butter now, which is basically just like guacamole spread onto some toast and then with some scrambled eggs on top. It's lovely.
Perfect.
Yeah. We're going off target a little bit. Sorry. Now, you talked about some of the symptoms there. And another question links in quite nicely to this is that overtraining symptoms are very, very similar to those of the menopause, particularly things like aching muscles, aching joints, fatigue. I know people, you know, I know some males who get hot flushes and hot sweats when they've been overtraining as well. Should we just presume we're overtraining and reduce our volume load until we feel better, or should we push through it if we can? So this is for most of my listeners who are probably busy training for triathlons at the same time as they're going through the menopause.
I think it's a really good question, isn't it? And I think it comes down to really knowing your body and knowing what overtraining looks like for you, if you've ever been in that sort of situation before. So what is your current training plan like? Are you aware that that is a load that would maybe push you to the edge a little bit? But also thinking about what else is going on in life as well, because we do know how important those stress hormones are. And if life outside of your training is really busy as well, then obviously that can have a big effect. But I think sometimes, you know, if you gave in to every little symptom that you had with the menopause and thought you should rest up, you probably wouldn't end up doing very much exercise, for some women anyway. So it is a case of really sort of tuning in and just thinking, what do I genuinely think this is? Am I really at a point where I might be overtraining? Is my training plan going fine? What happens when I push through? Do I feel okay? Am I exhausted for weeks afterwards? Am I refreshed after I've had recovery? And just trying to unpick it a little bit, because it can be a very, very difficult thing to know. And often it is trial and error and kind of feeling your way along and really, really trying to listen into your body.
I mean, that's a simple piece of advice that we give to a lot of people, is understanding your body and listening to it. And you know, for me, if you're feeling a little battered by your training, whether that's because of hormonal issues or just general life stress and fatigue, whether you're male or female, I don't know of any circumstances where backing off and having a couple of easy days would be a bad thing. And learning to see what happens. I know of lots of circumstances when pushing on regardless will have bad consequences, but going the other way, I've very rarely come across anything where something bad happens by having a day off.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is your mind, isn't it? It's feeling guilty. It's wondering whether you're doing the right thing. Are you just making an excuse? Are you, you know, it's easy. Sometimes it's hard to stay motivated to exercise, and sometimes you know, you do need a few days off, but sometimes equally you just need to tell yourself it was a bad day, and that doesn't mean the next day is going to be bad, and trying not to let that kind of carry over. And I think the thing with the menopause is that women experience these things, if they're having a difficult time with it, every single day, and it might be a completely different symptom from day to day. So it is trying to be sort of flexible and understand what's going on. And I agree, taking a step back every now and then, and not forcing yourself, but sometimes, once you get going, you feel okay, and you think, it's a very, very difficult thing.
Well, that's something that I was going to mention. I mean, you're a runner, right? Mm. I go running, I go swimming. There's days when I get in the pool or when I get out on the run and I feel shocking. I mean, I can't put it down to the menopause, so it's got to be something else. But I had a run last week and I felt it was probably because I had an omelette for lunch and it was a bit too close, but my legs felt heavy from the moment I set off. I carried on with the run, but I just felt like I don't really go on pace. I go by feel. But when I looked at my pace afterwards, it was so much slower than I normally run and it felt so much harder. But it was just a run. I did it. I have the option of walking. I have the option of walking home if it's not going well. I've been out for a run today and it just felt so different. So it's so clearly there was something about that day, what I'd done in the lead up to it, that made it feel bad. But yeah. if you're not feeling good about something, we'll start off, go for a walk and then see how you feel. Do a little bit of running. How does that feel? Maybe run for a minute, walk for a minute. How does that feel? Actually, it's not so good. I'll carry on walking. Oh, actually, it doesn't feel so bad. I'll carry on running.
Absolutely.
It's not a black or white thing, is it? You've got options all the way through a session to do what you plan to do or make it easier, depending on how you respond.
Yeah, it's being flexible. Or even, if you're feeling, really rubbish, then you do, have a good stretch session or do some core or something that doesn't mean that you're setting out on a long training run. So I think it is being flexible and just being looking at what you can do rather than what you can't, I think is always a good way to think about it.
We talked just briefly there then about feeling a bit heavy in the legs. Somebody's asked here what are the effects of perimenopause or even the menopause on training and performance?
Yeah, I mean, numerous things. Fatigue, feeling very, very tired, having low energy levels. I think a lot of that can be to do with the fact that your sleep can be very disturbed during the perimenopause. So it could be because maybe you're having night sweats, but also just because we know that the female hormones can help aid sleep. So as those estrogen and progesterone levels are falling, then that can sometimes have a kind of an effect of giving you insomnia and poor sleep aside from the sweats. So that obviously, fatigue then has a knock-on effect to your training and your performance, and that can vary day to day. Joint muscle aches and pains is another one, which is a perimenopausal symptom, which can again then can be quite confusing when you're an athlete, when you've got these sort of severe muscle pains, and then you're thinking, is that, like you said, because of overtrained, or is that because of the perimenopause? So that can be difficult, as well as the kind of physical symptoms of the perimenopause. So breast tenderness, for example, that's going to have an effect on your training. If you don't want to go out and run and jiggle them all around, then simple things like that you just don't think about, but actually there can be enough to stop you wanting to go out and do your training run. And I think as well, and maybe this kind of accounts sometimes for those days when you just feel awful, it is actually that we do think that the way your body uses food and metabolizes food changes around this time as well. So you can sometimes get increasing symptoms like diarrhea or constipation as a result of changing hormones, which can again have an effect on maybe how you would fuel yourself when you're training as well. So all sorts of ways, and the psychological effects as well, losing your motivation a little bit, sometimes maybe not concentrating or focusing so clearly, can then have a knock-on effect to your training and performance as well.
I mean, triathletes do have the benefit of three sports to choose from. So if you don't, if they don't want to go and get the feeling of jiggling them all about, as you say there, then they don't have to run. They don't have to run on that day. They could cycle or swim, which might be a little easier on the body. Certainly, I find that if I'm tired, then my joints tend to ache more from a run than they do from a cycle, just because of the high impact nature. Yep. So that would be
and a swim is great for that as well.
Yeah, a brisk walk. would be good, or something there. So triathletes perhaps a little bit more luckier than pure runners in that they've got other options.
Well, there's no reason why a runner can't get on a bike, you know.
No. So there's a couple of things here then. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned sleep there and how obviously sleep is disturbed. So for anybody who's having disturbed sleep, they would lead to increased fatigue, reduced ability to adapt to the training you're doing and recover from it. So somebody's asked the question, how to balance your training against being tired of continuous awakenings in the night due to sweats. Now, I'd guess that advice there will be the same as for anybody who's having low sleep, is you're going to have to cut your training back in order to balance the two out. There's no point in trying to continue with a heavy training load when you're not sleeping well.
Absolutely, yes. But I think important for everybody, whether menopausal or not, is to look at the simple things that you can do, you know, to improve your sleep habits. All this, you know, you'll have heard them all before, you know, keeping your bedroom cool and having a good routine and avoiding caffeine and alcohol. And actually avoiding the caffeine and alcohol, women who are perimenopausal do seem to be a little bit more sensitive to those as well. So that might be a particularly important step. And as I say, we do think that the falling hormone levels themselves are partly responsible for the disruption in sleep. And the other thing I think to mention as well, I'm sure, you know, we could talk about this in a minute, but if you are really having terrible sleepless nights with night sweats, which is stopping you being unable to perform, not necessarily in your sport, but in your day-to-day life, then, you know, you need to be thinking about whether HRT would be beneficial, because if you can dramatically improve your sleep through using some hormone replacement therapy, then you can dramatically improve your quality of life as well. So I think that's the situation where other athletes who aren't perimenopausal, there may be something different there.
We had sleep expert Nick Littlehales on a few weeks ago, and I think he was unfairly criticized because it seemed like he was dismissing the menopause when people were asking about interrupted sleep. But I think actually what he was trying to say was, look, it doesn't matter whether you're a 60-year-old guy, a 12-year-old growing boy, or a woman going through the menopause. If you have interrupted sleep and you wake up in the middle of the night, it's actually quite natural to wake up in the middle of the night after your deep sleep cycle comes to an end. Most people wake up 10 or 12 times during the night. They probably don't realize it half the time. And the strategies then for getting back to sleep are probably the same. You know, cool yourself down if you're hot. Maybe get up and read. And rather than lying there in bed frustrated that you can't get back to sleep, go and read somewhere quiet for half an hour until you feel sleepy again. Maybe do some yoga breathing or something that relaxes you if you feel like your heart's pounding a little bit. But it seemed like he was trying to dismiss the menopause as being almost fictitious, and of course it's not. But the problems are not restricted to people who are just suffering from the menopause when they wake up in the middle of the night. Anyway, that was my take on it, and that he did talk about those sleep habits you mentioned, and that's a good point that you raised there about sort of reducing your caffeine intake. I mean, I always advise people to perhaps stop drinking coffee after 12 noon, just because of the half-life of coffee and all of that. So that's definitely my own rule. And if you're going to have alcohol, I because this is another question we've got here. Somebody's, I don't know if you know much about heart rate variability, but I use a little app that checks mine. And what I have noticed is if I have a glass of wine early in the evening, it's mostly metabolized by bedtime. But if I have a glass of wine or another one just before bedtime, my sleep quality is definitely affected. So if you do want to have a drink, then carry on, but do it earlier on in the evening rather than just before bedtime.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think that women become or can become more susceptible to the effects of alcohol during the perimenopause. So, you know, women often anecdotally say, you know, they can't drink as much as they used to. They feel the effects more, they have more hangovers, and also that it definitely affects their sleep, and they maybe have more night sweats and flushes if they've been drinking. And I think, you know, you mentioned about the heart rate variability there, and you know, we know that your heart rate is controlled by your autonomic nervous system, you know, your automatic sort of nervous system. It's like a marker of that system. And the sweats and flushes that are triggered during the menopause are part of the autonomic nervous system as well. So we don't, you know, fully understand the link, but there is a definite link in the autonomic nervous system between the heart rate variability and sweats and flushes and temperature regulation, because that's controlled by the autonomic nervous system too. So it's easy to see why people sometimes say that their heart rate variability goes all over the place.
Well, that's what this sort of says, isn't it? Mine is all over the place. Yeah. But and of course, again, what I've found myself is that HRV often tells you or confirms what you probably intuitively think anyway, into like, I feel a bit stressed today, or I feel like I'm not sleeping very well, I feel wired, I feel like I'm just not recovered, well, my HRV is poor as well, you find that. So again, it's about learning what your body's telling you, and the general advice is, if your HRV is trending lower, you perhaps need to back off a little bit, because the total stress overload, and I think you've mentioned some there about stress hormones. So fight or flight hormones that we get, you know, everything you do in your life, whether you're rushing around collecting your kids, going to visit your mum in hospital because she's had a fall, or whether you're out running, they're all part of the fight or flight mechanism, that sympathetic nervous system. And we need to find a balance to that by adding in more parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest. So again, it's about the whole life load rather than just your training. And I think athletes are guilty of trying to separate out the two. There's my life there, and then there's my training here, as if they're two different separate bubbles that don't mix.
Yeah, most definitely. It's all about, the body just likes homeostasis, you know, it just likes to be perfectly in balance. And yes, you can feel that it's going out of balance in one way or another. You can't necessarily put your finger on it. And now we've got these new ways of measuring it, like heart rate variability, where, like you said before, you would have just done it by feel. So it's interesting, and I think there's a lot we don't understand about it. And I'm sure in time we'll find even more ways to measure our well-being, if you like.
Yes, all of these new wearables that are coming out. I do think in my previous podcast we were talking about how gadgets have almost taken away our ability to listen to what the body's telling us somewhat. So I think we've got to be careful not to stray too far away from that, because the most complex advanced machine that we have available to us is free, and we're already living inside of it, but we seem to have forgotten how to use it properly because these other new gadgets have come along that people think have superseded the body, but they never will.
No, we can't. We're cleverer than tech, aren't we, really, at the end of the day? Ditch the watch sometimes, definitely.
Yeah. Couple of medication questions here for you then, Juliet. Perimenopause and contraception. How do the hormones affect your body? Maybe as we've got athletes on there, we can talk about, does it affect, is there a difference in the way it affects your body because you're an athlete, or are we dealing with the human first and then adding the athlete on top of it? I suspect it's the latter.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think perimenopause in particular, it can sometimes be a tricky time to manage contraception because your fertility is low. I mean, having a pregnancy after the age of 50 is very rare, but it's not zero. So if you want to be certain of not getting pregnant, then you still need to maintain sort of effective contraceptive. But what you find is that at different points in your life, your contraceptive needs are different. So you perhaps don't need something as belt and braces as you did when you were 21. So I think it's sometimes actually thinking about what you're using, discussing with your doctor, is that still the right thing to be using, and being open to maybe trying something different or changing as well. Because when you're being given a hormonal contraceptive, you know, you're not going to be able to accurate. Some people aren't sure whether they're menopausal or not menopausal, especially if they're using a contraceptive that makes them bleed regularly, because that is controlling your cycle. So you'd think, oh well, I'll just have a blood test and it will tell me whether or not I'm menopausal. But it isn't going to work like that. You're not going to get an accurate blood test of your estrogen, progesterone, the other sex hormones that are checked if you're already taking a combined oral contraceptive, for example. I think sometimes it is actually just trying to look at the life cycle. Where, at what point are you in your fertility? What do you need right now? What would be the best thing that you could use? And again, that is very, very individual between different women and their own personal risks and their medical risks that they might have, as well as what their contraceptive needs are as well.
So that I think that's linked to the next question. Said my GP suggests I go off birth control, see if my body's ready to go on the menopause. Is it really necessary, and are there any downsides to staying on the low dose pill?
Yes, I mean, the pill, important to know that the pill won't affect when the menopause happens. It's not going to determine when you hit the menopause. That is something which is very inbuilt in people, but it can mask the symptoms of it. So if you're this lady was sort of saying, should I, yeah, my GP wants me to try stopping it to see whether I'm mm-hmm. menopausal or not. Like I say, you can't get an accurate blood test whilst you're on the combined pill. Whether you can stay on the low dose pill, as I say, really determined by your other risk factors, your family history of cardiovascular disease, strokes, deep mm-hmm. vein thrombosis. There are some women who do stay on a low dose estrogen combined pill. And that is not necessarily bad medicine. That's supposed to be satisfactory if your other medical and family history risks are low as well. And the combined pills can sometimes be quite helpful to manage bleeding, because often when women are perimenopausal, their bleeding is all over the place, and they can be really quite heavy, which if you're an athlete can be, you know, really, really difficult to train with. So sometimes a combined oral contraceptive is still the best thing, and it is preferred for it to be a lower dose if you're over 40. So it's this difficult time between kind of 40 and 50 when you're trying to balance everything out. And when you get to 55, pretty much you're okay and you can stop using contraceptive. So I think it is just having that conversation with your doctor about what your different options are, and then assessing the risks of each one and working out what's best for you. But just as I say, be aware that that may not be what you've been using for the past 30 years.
Okay. Go back to training then now. I think this question is going to cover, I think we might have covered this, but how to manage those unprepared for heavy feeling days while racing is just, my view, correct me if I'm wrong, is you just have to listen to your body and do what you can.
Yeah, I think so. Preparing yourself mentally, accepting that they happen, work with your body as much as you can, make sure you fuel yourself as well as you can, and do your best. There's sadly no kind of magic cure for stopping them happening.
There was another question on that. Was why does menopause make running so much harder, almost like your legs stop working? So is this just due to the fatigue? Is you talked about... We talked about muscles and joints or joints aching. Is there any neural aspect to this, to joint pain as well? And is that something that might be affecting the legs so that they feel like they're not yours?
I think probably bigger influence might be that your body's changing in how it produces fuel, how it metabolizes things as well. So sometimes if you haven't got the right fuel, then you can't simply get the energy from the food that you're having. So I think I don't think we fully understand really the effect that estrogen has on the joints and muscles and why we get these cramps, because cramps is another one. You know, it literally can just make your legs seize up, and I don't think we really fully understand it, if I'm quite honest. So you can only sort of do what you can to mitigate against it, and you just can't go. You know, and I think people do find that if they can adapt their training and adapt their nutrition, that they can minimize those as much as possible, but they're still going to happen from time to time. So preparing for them and not beating yourself up.
We talked about hydration earlier and how important that is, particularly if you're having the night sweats. We've got a question here that says, how best to rehydrate when having the sweats plus all the sweating in training? Now, there's always a big debate about whether cramps in athletes are as a result of muscular exertion, whether it is hydration or whether it's neural. Again, using I don't know whether GPs are fond of doing this, but coaches have this go-to phrase, which is, it depends. but would there be any rehydration advice that was different to athletes, just making sure you're taking fluid on board regularly, and Making sure that there are some salts in there, so you're getting electrolytes in, so not just drinking water.
Yeah, I don't think the hydration advice in that sense would be different. I think it would maybe just be to be aware that if you are having night sweats, you may lose a lot of fluid in the night. So perhaps having some extra in the morning to counteract that, or possibly if it's not going to make you go to the toilet too many times, a little bit extra before you go to sleep, so that you're not starting the day dehydrated. So perhaps reaching for something like that first thing with your breakfast if you have had a lot of night sweats. And I think that's probably the only difference in terms of what you would take in.
So I think all athletes are guilty of this, is that they are not that mindful of the fluid they're taking on board. And again, mindfulness is probably a link through a lot of the things we've discussed here. So being more mindful of your hydration needs versus your what your body's, your output, really, however that might be happening.
Yeah, I had read, and I haven't looked at the science behind this, but that women sometimes become less aware of their thirst in the perimenopause, and certainly postmenopausally. We get, you get thinking of elder people, they often don't feel thirsty. So if your thirst sense is reducing, then again, it's just being extra aware that maybe you're not quite so tuned into that.
We talked about joints a few times there. Somebody's said that they've heard that menopause can negatively affect my joints. I mean, we talked about them feeling a bit stiffer. Is there any weakening of the joints? Is there anything that happens to the tendons or ligaments that affects joint stability? I know that that's a concern sometimes when you're going through your monthly cycle, and I think during pregnancy as well, there's something around laxity around certain joints. Does that happen during the menopause?
Well, my understanding is that at those times during mid-cycle, etc., when you're more likely to strain your ACL ligament and things, is more to do with the rises in the hormone levels. Whereas here, we're looking at kind of reducing estrogen and progesterone in the menopause. And I think what the thinking is that those falling levels could potentially be increasing the inflammation in joints. So you get almost like an arthritic kind of picture as well, in which case, we know that movement is actually helpful. So it's important to be active. And I think a lot of people find that those symptoms can be worse in the morning when they first wake up. I think a lot of people find this as they get older, they're increasingly stiff in the morning. Yeah. So perhaps thinking about when you're training and trying to look at better times in the day that might make it more comfortable for you to do it, and warming up well as well to get the synovial fluid flowing, and maybe making a little bit more of a slow start to your exercise so that you're fully warmed up.
Yeah, feeling stiffer and tighter in the morning is not exclusive to women going through the menopause. I can tell you, I now have to do a good 20-minute mobility routine in the morning. I mean, that's partly down to habit and partly down to encouragement from my physio that I need more mobility anyway. But I think that's just part of the aging process, whoever you are. I've not heard of this phrase before, menopause belly. Now, is that related to GI issues that we talked about, or is that related to holding of more fluid, or distribution of body fat at all? And if so, what nutrition tips can you provide for fighting?
Yeah, I think this is a really important. This is actually a really important point, and this goes along with the changing metabolism of women in the perimenopause. That all of a sudden you become somebody who puts weight on around the tummy, so the increased fat deposition around your middle, as well as sort of losing muscle mass, you gain fat. And it can be incredibly frustrating for women. They haven't changed what they're eating. They haven't changed the intensity or volume of their exercise. And all of a sudden, they're getting a belly. It can be quite upsetting for women. And I think this is one of the, as a GP, this is one of the real common complaints that I would see women. One of the things they struggled with most around the menopause was the fact that their body changed and they gained fat and they often gained weight. And I think a lot of this is to do with our metabolism, the way our body's dealing with food, and its insulin sensitivity tends to sort of increase, will become a bit more resistant to insulin, I should say, which again makes us sort of hold on to fat, and we burn fat less slowly than we used to. So we definitely become much more likely to develop a belly. And I think, you know, we know that having increased fat around your middle often relates to you having increased fat around your organs. That's your visceral fat, you know, that harmful kind of internal fat as well. So what we need to be sort of aware of is, if that is happening to us, is that perhaps we need to mix things up a little bit and try and do what we can to improve our insulin resistance and make sure that we are insulin sensitivity, and make sure that we are helping our body to metabolize in the right way. So again, that is when it comes to nutrition, moving away from those sort of stodgy carbs, getting your carbs from your fruit and your vegetables, and also building our muscle mass, you know, because our muscles burn energy, if you like. So that belly fat developing is sometimes a sign because our muscle mass is reducing, and if we can increase our muscle mass, that can sometimes really help to kind of overcome and fight that menopause belly, alongside looking at your diet, obviously, as well. Something I think is important to mention as well, and maybe we don't talk about this very much, but is that it's not just what you do when you're training, it's what you do the rest of the time as well. And we're increasingly aware how important sedentary behavior is. And you may have a fantastic training plan that you follow to the letter, but if you're spending the rest of the time sitting at a desk, then you're going to be at higher risk of developing fat around your middle and storing fat. Your body kind of switches off, it goes into storage mode, and you do retain, you do start to retain more fat. So move more often, she says, sitting at her desk for a podcast. Well,
so there's a couple of interesting points you made there. More fat around the middle is more of an android male fat distribution, isn't it?
Totally.
That we talked about. And I guess that's to do with the change in the hormones, less estrogen and progesterone. Do females generate a little bit more testosterone then in response to that?
They don't necessarily generate more, but it's the balance. It's balance between the two. So that can definitely happen, yep.
I definitely got lift heavy weights there, because that is the conundrum, isn't it? Or the contradiction in a lot of people's minds is, if we're gaining weight, we need to burn more calories. And so to burn more calories, we need to go out and do more cardio exercise to burn them off. And of course, I always think that burning cardio exercise is a bit like turning the light on and off in the room. You know, while you've switched the light on, the light's shining, and then you turn it off and it's off immediately. And that's what happens with pretty much with cardiovascular exercises, that while you're doing exercise, you burn calories, and then at least after a few minutes after you've stopped, you stop burning calories and you go back to your resting metabolic rate. If you're lifting weights, it's like having the thermostat constantly turned up a degree, because you're always burning calories even while you're asleep. So we go back to that thing we talked about at the beginning there about lifting heavy stuff, which is, you know, vital. The other thing you've talked about there, which is something I'm just currently researching for a blog post, is this active couch potato thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's a fair bit of research now. I think quite a lot of it came from Australia, from a female researcher in Australia, which showed that if you're an athlete, so take me and you, we go running in the morning, and because we've done our 1 hour run before breakfast and then we go to the office, we feel morally superior to all of our sedentary colleagues. Yeah. And so for the rest of the day, we sit in front of our desk thinking, well, I've trained an hour and I'll do it tomorrow. But they actually showed that health-wise and in terms of calorie burn, the people who are sedentary for most of the days but just get up every hour and potter around the office to make a cup of tea or go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. they're actually better off than the ones who exercise and then do nothing. And again, another contradiction, and definitely not intuitive, but something that I think we perhaps all need to wake up to if we spend a lot of time in the office.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is one of the messages that we were delivering when I was working for Public Health England, you know, that actually you can be an exercising couch potato. You can't do park run on a Saturday morning and then watch Netflix lying on the sofa for the rest of the weekend and think one balances the other out. You know, there's independent risk factors from your sedentary behaviour, particularly type 2 diabetes. It's a simple thing to do. It's just a case of getting into the habit of it. And it doesn't have to be much. It can literally be standing up, walking around, just moving more And looking at things like standing desks and things as well to make that easier.
There's, I don't know if you're familiar with Ben Greenfield, but he did a podcast with a guy who does some of those, he calls it lifestyle furniture, but stand-up desks. And he talks about there's some receptors in the blood which help transport low-density lipoproteins, so the bad cholesterols. And they are busy at work, but if you sit down for more than an hour to an hour and a half, they tend to go to sleep, and so they stop doing their job. So you need to keep moving to waken them up.
I think it's probably lipoprotein lipase. It's an enzyme that breaks down fat, and after about 20-30 minutes of sitting, that kind of switches off, and yeah, your body flips into storage mode. So just getting up and moving around can really make a big difference, even though it's a small thing. And I think sometimes we don't think about that when we're so used to training. You know, rest is good, obviously, but it's that daily behavior that really can affect us without us necessarily knowing it.
I think, yeah, LPP1 that was the one that sort of switches off if you stay sat down for too long. So I'm quite into this idea now of what they call micro workout. So I have my kettlebells downstairs, and every hour I will go down there and I'll do some kettlebell swings, I'll do some press ups. I have a little grid on my whiteboard now, and I just tick them off so that I go through these exercises throughout the day rather than having one 20-minute spell when I do all of them.
Perfect. Yeah, that's good. Great way to do it.
Yeah, I'm trying to talk the talk and walk the walk.
I usually get up and walk downstairs and put the kettle on.
Whatever it is, I think we just need to be mindful of moving more often, don't we?
And totally. That's all it is.
Sitting at a desk. So if you've got a little buzzer on your phone or on your computer that tells you to get up and move around, then do it. A few supplemental questions here that are coming up. Is there a best supplement or tablet to take for balancing hormones?
I'm not a huge kind of advocate of supplements, really. You know, I feel quite strongly that with a good diet, we can get really what we need. And you know, there are so many things out there that claim to be good in the situation of managing sweats and flushes. And that's because women are, you know, they're desperate sometimes and they want to try things. But I suppose with my GP hat on, I have to look at what the evidence is behind them. And is there enough evidence to prove that there is definite benefit there? And there's very little. There will always be a study of some sort that says something's going to work, but you know, how good is the study? How many people was it done on? Were they given a placebo as well? You know, is it a good quality study? And actually there's very little that comes out well in terms of that. I think the one that comes out best is black cohosh as a supplement to help reduce perimenopausal symptoms. A good place to go for information is to look at the website Menopause Matters, because that's very evidence-based. It's written by a team of doctors that do look carefully at the evidence behind things. So you can read on there about different supplements, etc., as to what the benefits and things might be. Red clove is the other one, which is sometimes mentioned as well. So those black cohosh, red clove are probably the most common. And again, you're never 100% sure when you're buying something like that, what the strength of it is that you're buying. Is that going to be enough to make symptoms disappear, and how you as a person individually might benefit? Some you have to be a little bit careful if you're taking other medications that might interact with them as well. So it's always best to try and get some good advice. But if there was something magical that did it, I would be a millionaire.
I think that's one of the issues with living in the 21st century, isn't it? Is that we get so used to instant gratification that we want that for everything. And as a GP, I've got friends who are GPs. I know that there'll be a lot of patients who come in wanting, you know, something prescribed to fix it now. And actually, living a healthy life and all the things we talked about just require hard work consistently. You know,
they do
the simple stuff. There's no real answer to anything that's going to happen overnight.
But as we mentioned before with the turmeric, you know, if there's something that isn't going to do any harm and you want to try it and it helps you, great. You know, there's no judgment. You it helps then, and it's not going to do any harm, then carry on. Because interestingly, sometimes the placebos do really well in these studies. So if you've got something and it is helping, then I'm not going to tell you not to take it.
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, I've said many times is, look, I'm not bothered about the research. The consensus of the research might suggest that this doesn't work. But in any research, there's outliers, people who have no effect at all or no response, and others who have amazing responses. They just don't form the 80% and make up the main consensus of, does this really work? But if you're the one person, the N equals one study where taking turmeric magically cures all of your symptoms, then don't let what the research says stop you. You know, if as long as you're not eating something that's poisonous or deleterious to your health, that's again, I don't see any downsides to something like that.
Yeah, and a lot of time it's trial and error. I think it's just difficult because women often are very desperate and a lot of these things are very expensive. So it's easy to get drawn into to buying things and then finding they don't work. But yeah. But have a look at Menopause Matters for that, I would.
One of the things that concerns athletes, particularly those who might represent their age group for Great Britain or compete in competitions where they do random drug tests, is whether any of these substances have performance enhancements and whether you might get, if you were tested, whether you might get tested positive or whether you would, you know, if they're on the banned substance list or whether you would need a TUE, therapeutic use exemption form. I know a lot, there are male athletes who question, you know, at my age, whether they've got low testosterone and they need testosterone supplements and whether that would require a TUE. In fact, there's a case where a guy was banned for taking his own testosterone that he bought, and he didn't tell everybody. He's continued to do it because for other reasons, but he's been banned now for life.
Yeah, I think it's difficult when it comes to hormones, isn't it? And again, I don't claim to be an expert on this at all. And I know testosterone is really one of the most important ones that is a banned substance. So generally, my understanding is that the estrogen, progesterone, like you would use in a contraceptive pill or some of the HRTs, isn't going to be an issue. I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? Because, and somebody I think asked this question as well, you know, if you're using HRT, then can it be performance enhancing? And if it makes you sleep well, then and you can train better, then absolutely. You know, if it removes all that brain fog and you can see clearly and you've got energy and your joint pains have disappeared, then it's going to enhance your performance. But is that an unfair advantage? You're just someone who happens to be severely affected by menopause symptoms. And I think sometimes with the menopause and supplements, et cetera, the ingredients can be very varied and they can be different quantities and different names, etc., in whatever you're taking. So I would say if you have any doubt, just ask, you know, get something checked, read the label, what's in it, etc., and look it up on the it's WADA, isn't it, the website, because there's a list of the banned substances on there, and you can actually see, because testosterone is a no, but it's unusual for women in the UK anyway to be prescribed testosterone. There are some situations when it is used, but it's not used in a traditional HRT, if you like. So that shouldn't be an issue. But as I say, I'm not an expert in that field. And I think if you're unsure, then double check. But you may get some performance enhancement in some ways, but is that giving you an unfair advantage over someone who's not got such severe symptoms?
there's a lot of grey areas around that, isn't it? It's a bit like the altitude tents versus living altitude. You know, one's an artificial environment created, the other one's just available if you've got a bit of money and you can afford to move to St Moritz. But even then, it's an advantage, isn't it? You know, if you were born in Kenya and you live in the Rift Valley or somewhere at 10,000 feet or whatever, or born in Colombia in the Andes, you've got that unfair advantage. What about mental health? We haven't talked about that much today, but I guess that changes in your body, things that are happening that you don't like happening, getting up to go for a run and just feeling too tired are bound to have if you love getting out and going for a run, are bound to have an effect on your mental health if it's an ongoing sort of can't see the light at the end of the tunnel process. Have you noticed much of that about anxiety and about just the mental health aspects rather than just the physical ones? And the person who's asked this question also says, how does that contribute to losing our desire to compete?
I think it's a hugely important area. As I say, when I was working as a GP, often when women would come to me about the menopause, they wouldn't be coming with physical symptoms. Mm. They would be coming with mental symptoms, but they didn't actually even realize that they were related to the menopause. So they actually thought they were going mad, losing the plot, forgetting things, mood all over the place, just wondering whether they might even have early onset dementia. And I think it's, yes, there's the fact that you might not get your training in if you're feeling physically unable to do it, so you don't get the mental health boost from that point of view. But there's actually the hormones themselves having a direct effect on your mood through their links in the brain, the way they interact with the endorphins, and the having less estrogen and progesterone can affect the amount of endorphins that you might produce. And you know, we know that progesterone itself has some kind of calming effects. So if your progesterone levels are falling, then things like your anxiety levels might increase as well. So there's definite link actually with the hormonal changes, as well as not necessarily getting such a big boost from the exercise that you're actually doing. And I think it can affect your desire to compete. It can affect your motivation to do anything. So that most definitely can have a knock-on effect to your competitive nature as well. So I think it is a huge area and something that we really mustn't overlook.
Mental health's going to be a big thing, isn't it, for GPs coming up? Not because of this, just because of the whole coronavirus thing. It's already much closer to the front of our thoughts. You know, I think was it World Mental Health Day last week, maybe Saturday?
Yes, it was Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, so, another friend of mine who's a triathlete, he's a GP, and he was saying, you know, mental health, we're seeing just so many more cases of that now coming into the clinic. And that's not to mention all of your colleagues who've been on the front line who haven't managed to stop for breath yet to consider getting their sleep, never mind their mental health, but that's bound to hit us all at some point in the future.
Yeah, it's. I do think it's something that we are becoming better at talking about, though, which can only be a good thing. But what are going to be the impacts on mental health of coronavirus in the UK from this? It's scary to think about. Really, there's a lot of loneliness and isolation. Yes, there are communities coming together, and there have been some benefits as well. So that's important to recognise. But on the whole, it's testing times.
Yeah, and again, we talked about mental health. We talked about what partners and friends can do right at the beginning. Communication, listening, just listening to somebody talking, not trying to give advice, because I know men are pretty good at that, aren't they? You know, when your partner says, I'm not feeling so good, he's dishing out advice rather than just listening and letting them sort of get stuff off the chest. So certainly not being alone with it and being able to talk and other people being able to listen is a big help, I guess, particularly at times when in lockdown, other areas of communication, like being able to go and see your GP as freely, perhaps aren't as easily available.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it is understanding and knowing that mood can be so badly affected by the menopause is really important, just to even know that fact. We know that women are more likely to become depressed around that time and have increasing symptoms of anxiety, and just kind of linking the two and having an understanding of that can sometimes help you to work out the best way forward, and sharing with somebody else, and it's good to talk, as they say. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're getting towards the end of these questions now. It's been a marathon session so far, hasn't it? I hope you've been preparing well for it over the last few weeks.
Endurance levels are pretty good at the minute, so we're okay.
Yes. Well, there's only a few left to go, and these are mostly aimed at post-menopause now. So from some of our older female listeners, looking at the ages that some of them are quoted. So our first question says, I'm 62 and I'm post-menopause. My concerns around training intensity, heart and vascular health without all my hormonal protection. We've spoken a little bit about this, haven't we, about the potential for increased cardiac risk. So any actions that we can be taking, or that listeners can be taking there to mitigate and minimise these somewhat?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, we know that estrogen is kind of protective against cardiovascular disease, if you like. So when the estrogen levels drop and you're post-menopause, then there's a higher risk of heart disease. And, you know, we do know that heart disease is the biggest killer in women, and it's often not something, you know, you think maybe people associate it more with male death than they do with female death. But we all have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease as we age. And I think what's important to remember really is that, you know, one of the things that we can do to mitigate that risk is to exercise. You know, because the estrogen has been sort of stopping the plaque formation in the blood vessels, protecting it against high cholesterol. What else can we do when we exercise? We can lower our blood pressure. We can reduce our body fat. We can reduce our risk of getting visceral fat, you know, that harmful fat gathering around our organs, and our inflammation, all those things that we know are cardiovascular risk factors. So yes, although when you're postmenopausal, you might have concerns about training because you're worried about not having the hormonal protection, actually one of the best things you can do is to exercise, because then you can mitigate against those other risk factors. So I think perhaps it's actually thinking about it the other way around, and knowing that actually that it's more important than ever that you exercise.
Would there be anything around training intensity there? I mean, would you, if you were 62 and you'd been participating in endurance sports for a while and through the menopause, would you have any different advice for people there with intensity as you would to anybody else? You know, do they need to be more concerned about it, or do they just have to listen to the body and know what the body can cope with?
I think I wouldn't have any more concerns than anybody else. If they've been training like that throughout their life, they know that they're training sensibly, they're training gradually, then I wouldn't give them any different advice. I would to a 62-year-old woman who had never exercised before in terms of suddenly doing high-intensity exercise. But no, it's something their body's used to it. They've been training throughout their lives. I think that they can be lowering their risk by being active and working hard.
I've been involved in a couple of heart research projects, both of them were for males only. But one of the things I do get from male triathletes is that they're worried sometimes about intensity as they get older. And yet the data that's coming out of the research is that intensity on its own isn't really the cause. You know, you often hear about people having cardiac incidents in races when they've done some high intensity work, but that's really a trigger, but it isn't the problem really. And what the issues around the heart's around environmental issues, genetic, life stresses, chronic overload from training, things that have happened in the past, and that one's the catalyst. But on its own, there's nothing wrong with the occasional amount of intensity as long as it's well prescribed and well managed.
Yeah, I think, again, in this area, most of the research has been done in men. So you're looking at male athletes and the risk of them developing things like atrial fibrillation, and, you know, can very high intensity exercise for long periods of time increase the scarring within your heart, which can then sort of affect the electrical pathways through the heart and put you at more risk of, and we do know that older male athletes are definitely at more risk of developing atrial fibrillation. But I think we don't really have enough studies to give this information in women particularly. So I think it is another area, as I say, over time that we will find out more about. But if somebody has been doing this for years and they're otherwise fit and well, that's not going to be a major problem in my eyes.
Moving on from there then, would you have any recommendations for recovery from training and or recommended supplements for this stage of life? Well, you've made it fairly clear what you're thinking there about supplements is that, you know, before you go down that road, if I've picked up what you're saying is right, just do everything you can with eating real food, really.
Yes,
getting
definitely.
Nutrient density and cutting out the rubbish, really.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of question asked about recovery as well, and I think recovery is particularly important, and it's probably worth mentioning on its own because we do know that, you know, generally recovery processes slow down as we get older, you know, and we want to preserve, particularly thinking of our joint health, you know, we want to keep our knees good, and we do need to allow our body enough time to recover after training to readjust itself, for those joints to repair themselves, et cetera, et cetera. So, and we do know those processes slow down a little bit as we age. So I probably would recommend extra recovery and building in enough rest days. Sometimes hard to do when you're keen, but actually will, you know, pay off in the longer term.
Yeah, I think that's good general advice, actually, not just restricted to females post-menopause. I know myself, I can still do high intensity training and I can still train hard. I just need longer to put it in. So what I might used to be able to accomplish in 2 weeks, I have to put it over 4 weeks now. But I can still do the training. They just, maybe instead of doing a hard session every other day, it's every 3 or 4 days now. But that's about getting consistency, isn't it? You can go for the hero sessions for 2 weeks and then do nothing, or you can be a bit more moderate and keep it going over the next few months.
Definitely. Although sometimes I think you can be in a little bit of denial about it, maybe, and you kind of don't want to think of yourself as getting older or I need a bit longer to recover. It's just not being in denial and just taking it for what it is and working with it.
That's the issue with athletes, though, isn't it? They have a chronological age of however many years they've been on this planet, but they've got a mental age of 25 and still behave like that. I think, I'm not sure if we've covered this one. This is the final question here. What are the effects of hard training on our body at this stage? Are there physiological changes we need to be aware of on our heart, muscles, tendons? This is in post-menopause. Or should we just self-limit depending on how we feel?
Yeah, I guess we've kind of covered that, really, haven't we? I mean, self-limiting is important. Thinking about the stress on our body that training causes, and stress generally in life, you know, in the cortisol levels, and trying to manage those. We do know that when we're in those sort of older years, if you like, our blood vessels can be a little bit less compliant, a little bit less sort of flexible, and you can, changes in your blood pressure can be a little bit slower as well. And as I mentioned before, quite a bit, you know, about the core temperature of women changing, and sometimes finding it harder to deal with heat. So thinking about how to manage that, and sort of hydrating your body as much as possible. So I think, you know, all in all, it is self-limiting. We shouldn't ignore it. It sounds like you say, silly, say listen to your body. And sometimes it's really hard to listen to your body because you've actually got to listen properly and be aware of it and be willing to adapt to the changes that you think your body's telling you. It's quite easy to ignore it sometimes. So I think there's tuning in and looking at, yes, you can look at stats, but actually how you feel is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's, I think you've mentioned it before, that can be quite a difficult thing, can it? Or can't it, listening to your body? Because sometimes you think, well, I'm just taking the easy option here. I'm just telling myself I feel tired when I should be able to get out for a run. But you can always start and stop, can't you? And this,
absolutely.
Yeah. I usually associate that sort of behavior with men who, you know, I'm going on my run and I've decided I'm doing it, so I'm going to finish. You know, they won't let the ego, their ego won't let them stop. Females are usually a bit more mindful about stuff.
I hope so.
my observation, purely observational. Okay, right, Juliet, I've taken enough of your time, but before you go, is it possible for us to condense everything we've talked about in the last 90 minutes down to 4 or 5 actions that we can take to sort of minimize the effects of each stage of the menopause? I mean, there's several things that have cropped up regularly, isn't there, in that conversation just now?
Yeah. So I would say, first of all, whether you're a woman going through it, a partner, a coach, whatever, inform yourself. You know, read, learn as much as you can, and talk about it. So kind of actually raising the issues of the topics and making sure you know as much about it as you can is hugely important. Second, I would probably think of this time, perimenopause, leading up to the menopause, as a kind of an opportunity, if you like, to make some changes for the better, to look at improving your diet, Looking at your sleep patterns, looking at your caffeine, alcohol, etc. Sort of think of it as an opportunity rather than necessarily something to be dreading. It's a change, but some change can sometimes be good. Talk about diet. I would say power. Look at weights. Look at lifting heavy things. So you're looking at power rather than necessarily volume, looking at the intensity of what you're doing, so that you're increasing your muscle mass, preserving. And I didn't mention this before, but when you're working against resistance, that's improving your muscle mass, but actually it's improving your bone health too. And we now know it's not just high impact stuff that improves bone health. So if you are doing anything that makes the tendon tug on the bone, that will actually help to stimulate bone mass too.
I've always thought that that's particularly important for females who, you know, if you're walking around, you're always working against gravity through the legs, but often females seem to lack upper body strength because they sort of, maybe it's a cultural thing, but they tend not to lift heavy stuff. So certainly upper body weights is important. Most females, pound for pound, tend to be as strong as men, I think, that haven't done any additional training, but certainly not in the upper body. So that would be my prescription as a strength coach as well, is try and focus more on the upper body. And also this thing about, well, if I lift heavy weights, I'm going to gain muscle. You need testosterone and you need huge quantities of food to build big muscles. So unless you're supplemented with both of those, that's not going to happen, particularly if you're an endurance athlete doing lots of swimming and cycling as well. But it will have profound impacts on your quality of life and on your ability to maintain your performance as an athlete as well.
Yeah, and I'd
give a money back guarantee on that one.
My other point, I would say, we talked briefly about this, but actually adding some balance and coordination exercises to your workouts as well. You mentioned that sort of neural link, and if you don't use those pathways, then you lose them. So spending time doing body balance exercises, standing on one leg, looking at your coordination, because we know that reduces with time, particularly after the menopause as well. And that's something that we often overlook and get involved with other training as well. So that would definitely be on my list.
Brilliant. Well, Juliet, you truly are an endurance GP. You're still smiling. You've still got the energy. I can see your head's dropping a little bit there now, but that's been fantastic this afternoon. Thank you so much. I've really appreciated your input and the conversation. You've definitely educated me a little bit about all of this. And I hope that the females who ask the questions have answers. I'm sure we can find some way of continuing the conversation off air if necessary for those who want more, but I don't want to increase your workload. And we have got several resources where we can direct people to. You mentioned Menopause Matters.
Yep, that's their website. Yep, they have a magazine as well.
Yeah, so that's one that I'm going to for those who are concerned, I'm going to find the banned substances list. I'm definitely going to reference your website, your own personal website. I'm going to reference your book. If there's anything else that you think I should be referencing, you can send it to me off air. Unless you want to tell us now.
No, I was just going to say to put Raw Dr. Stacey Sims' book in there, because that's particularly good for triathletes that are training. In her menopause chapter, she's got specific kind of recommended diet plans as well. So.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been fantastic. Thank you. So as I say, I hope we've answered the questions from our listeners. If you're a male coach, or if you are the partner or husband or brother of somebody who's currently going through this, then hopefully it's educated you a little bit. And please do continue that education and follow Juliet's advice to just not just learn about it, but communicate and talk and ask the questions so you can find out more and find out how you can help.
Brilliant. Thank you for talking about the subject.
No, and thank you for joining us, Juliet. Best wishes and good luck if you get called back into the ranks of practicing GP.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out.
If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.